What makes a child want to learn? One thing is certain. When a child is ready to learn something, he will learn it with joy. It'll be a happy experience. Children want to repeat happy experiences, so chances are when he's ready for the next step, he'll approach it with expectation and confidence. In order for any child to be ready for new experiences, he needs to feel good about himself. He needs to feel like a winner. It all depends on how the adults around him feel about him. This will determine his feeling about himself. Bernard in Child Development and Learning says, quote, mere words such as brat, squalling kid, ornery, stupid, are believed to start the baby on a destructive course of life. Other mere words such as lovable, darling, sweet, bright, beautiful, precious, tend to engender in the baby quite another personality pattern and perspective on life. And then he continues, personality is the sum total of one's physical, mental, emotional, and perceptual traits and habits. And it includes one's past experiences, present conditions, and the possibility of what one might become. It includes the view others take of all the foregoing. Social engineering promises the optimistic prospect of our being able to help children learn how to become productive, socially considerate, self-actualized human beings. Notice, he doesn't say straight-A students or football heroes or musically talented or movie stars. Children perform better when their parents and teachers have faith in them, expect they can achieve the task at hand, and know the children can accomplish difficult jobs. This is known as a self-fulfilling hypothesis. Children need recognition for their accomplishments. If it's a painting they did at school, parents should recognize their efforts to please, admire it. You don't have to say that's a great painting or they know whether they're happy with it or not. And a lot of times when parents say that's just beautiful, they know it isn't. Then the parent loses a bit of respect as far as the child is concerned. So there are a lot of other ways to approach it in a positive way. Tell me about it. What is it? Really might perturb the child a little bit. But if we give him an opportunity to tell about it in his own words, not press him, allow him to tell about it if he wants to, then the child, I think, will feel better about his product. Usually with a child and a painting, it isn't the product that's important anyway, it's the process he goes through in painting that's important to him. I know one time when the children were painting and I was going around looking at all the paintings and admiring them and sometimes not saying anything but just smiling at them. And one child had a lovely, lovely painting, and I went on around and looked at all the other paintings and came back to him, and his painting was gone. It was just covered with brown. I didn't say anything, but he looked at me and he said, it's behind the wall. So he had painted a wall in front of his lovely garden that he had before. To him, there was an explanation for just a plain brown painting. Children do not grow and develop best under great pressure. Creativity rarely develops from outward pressure. It may come from the inner pressure of ideas which flow into the mind and demand a way of expression. When curiosity and interest are aroused, the child will want to exert pressure from within himself to accomplish what he is eager and able to do. He'll often attempt difficult and challenging things with excitement and joy. Happy children are generally busy and good-natured and constructive with happy smiles and sparkly eyes. They are secure in love and ego growth. They think well of themselves and are happy just to be. In the words of one four-year-old, I'm glad I'm me. A child who knows he is loved even when he's naughty has a head start in what we think of as ego strength. To withdraw our love when a child has disobeyed or hasn't performed as we had hoped he would perform is not only cruel, but it's devastating. Although it's up to us to give them positive direction, at the same time, it is important that they know they have the freedom to make mistakes. It's also important for us as adults to know that we have the freedom to make mistakes. There are no perfect parents, and there are no perfect teachers, just as there are no perfect children. The moment we set ourselves up as supreme, infallible authorities, we're in trouble. Have you ever noticed how supportive children can be when you admit you've made a mistake? Remember, we are models. I have noticed that not only with my own children at home when they were little, but in nursery school. The minute you say, oh boy, did I goof, that's okay, Mommy, or that's okay, Mrs. Edmund. They love us a little more, I think, when they realize that we are not infallible and that we're ready to admit our mistakes. It really helps the rapport. If we want them to admit their mistakes, we must create an atmosphere of forgiveness and grace. This will encourage openness, and it'll discourage deceit and lying. Children and people of all ages need an atmosphere of warmth in which to thrive, the warmth of close, honest human contacts. They need the feeling that adults like them, are interested in them, enjoy them, and feel ready to be responsible for them, to protect them even from themselves when occasion demands. A child's first comprehensions are deeply personal. Who they are, what they do, what they have, how they get it, where they live, where they go, what they like, what frightens them, what makes them happy. Skillful understanding is needed by the adults around them to help build a bridge between these basic needs and interests to the needs of others in the world. When we become sensitive to the relation between a child's interest in himself and his slowly maturing interest in other people, we can help him maintain a delicately balanced equation between self-fulfillment and self-extension. When he's still young, the child needs help toward feeling the confidence of familiarity and power in the world. We must support his movement toward autonomy. And of course, this goes for every stage of growth. The child has to feel that he can determine his life to a certain extent, within limits, of course, but that he can make some decisions. And I think that the wise parent will allow him to increasingly make his own decisions as he grows. And we all know how important it is for the teenager. This old quote from the teenager, "Get off my back," is just that. Let me decide. You don't have to keep interfering. I am responsible. And but even at the very young age, you know, the age of 2, no is a common expression. They assert their rights. They don't do what the parent wants them to do the minute the parent wants them to do it. They're exerting their autonomy. And of course, at the age of 3, it's, I can do it myself. And we need to respect his right to do it himself, at least try. I remember one child who would come to nursery school every Monday morning with his fists clenched. And he was ready to flay out at anyone. And he was very physical in his response to other children. It was just like he was ready to blow up. So I knew there must be something going on at home during the weekend that built up this tension that he could release. And so we had a conference, and the parents admitted that this was their only child and they really wanted to do a good job with him. And of course they were just trying too hard to be the perfect parents. And on top of it, they had a new home, a new yard, newly seeded, so their child wasn't able to the freedom of, the physical freedom he needed for a growing boy. And they had a new home, so of course he had to be very careful in the house. And there were just restrictions. And they admitted this, and I said, well, do you ever let him make any decisions of his own? A four-year-old making decisions, what kind of decisions can he make? Well, I suggested they might allow him to decide what he's going to wear at school. No, they didn't do that, but they possibly could. So just put his school clothes in a certain place so he can choose from them. And we talked about their taking time to play with him and allow him physical freedom, and they admitted that they were just too restrictive and that they were going to try to do better because they could see what was happening to him too at home. And he just blossomed out. It was beautiful to watch because they cooperated at home. And his dad told me that when he was putting him to bed one night, he said, do you love me even when I'm naughty? Mrs. Edmund says that she does, and she says that you love me when I'm naughty too, and God loves me when I'm naughty. Is that right, Dad? He hurried up and gave all the answers, you know, not giving his dad even a chance to say no. But this was on his mind. He had felt from his parents that they wanted so much that he be perfect, that he had no room to make mistakes, and that if he did, they would withdraw their love from him. And that's quite a burden for a child to bear. It's a burden for anyone to bear. We must respect our child's preferences. Welcome his exploring by providing rich experiences as a base for spontaneous and genuine knowing, and extend his cognitive resources with first-hand contacts that nourish discovery, perception, concepts, and opinions. And if you're familiar with Piaget and his theory of conceptual learning, you'll hear him in that statement. Start with experiences, the real thing, something close to the child. His learning must be his own, accomplished through the intrinsically child ways of doing, exploring, and experimenting. We must become his support and guide, the person who helps him clarify his confusion, introduce him to experiences that feed his interests, provide his next steps. We must become his ally and his friend. He must be helped to feel first that he belongs in the world, and second, that the world belongs to him, that it is his world, and it is utterly appropriate that he shall approach it in a spirit of constant expectation and interest in making it over. Young children do not learn in a straight line on schedule. In their drive for autonomy, they attack the grown-up systems of values without knowing it. They trigger feelings and situations the adults may never have had to cope with before. They expect parents and teachers to help them find ways of making an impact upon the world legitimately. Mary Jane's mother came with her the first day of nursery school and she said, you know, it's either you or a psychiatrist. And I said, what do you mean? Well, she said, Mary Jane's brother is under the care of a psychiatrist. She's having tantrums every day. Sometimes they last 2 hours. And I said, what triggers it, the tantrums? And they said, well, if she gets a pink spoon instead of a green spoon at lunch, she has a tantrum. I said, why isn't she setting the table? It hadn't occurred to them that that Mary Jane was wanting to make some choices here now. And it certainly wouldn't make any difference to the parents whether she got pink spoons or green spoons. She should be dealing them out to the rest of the family too, and setting the table and helping. And this was the problem. Her mother had waited on her hand and foot just as she had waited on her brother hand and foot. And when children aren't allowed to do for themselves, they really start losing respect for themselves. They start believing that maybe they can't do it, and it frustrates them because they want to do it. But most parents are willing to listen and to try a new tact if they see that what they're doing isn't getting the results. So it wasn't long until Mary Jane's mother said that the tantrums had decreased. She was helping, doing all sorts of things at home, and she had noticed that her leadership of the other children in the backyard had become much more tactful and had improved, so that she was getting the experience of autonomy she had wanted. And as she experienced more and more of her own autonomy, she started dropping her bad habits of tantrums and fingernail biting and all these little things that she had taken up simply because she was full of frustration. And sort of came to a climax when she was going to register for kindergarten. She went to the kindergarten roundup, and her mother called me afterwards, and she said, "You know, Mary Jane said to me, 'Now, Mother, you're not the one that's getting, that's registering. I am. So why don't you just give me the 75 cents for the insurance and then let me do it?'" Well, she said, she was the only kid in line without a mother, but she let her go ahead. And she got up there and gave them all the right answers and told their address and telephone number and where her father worked and all that sort of thing. And she said that she came out of that line just feeling, just beaming. She had done it. Well, some children have a terrific leadership drive, much more than others. Another child the same age might have been very happy to have mommy very close at that time, and I imagine most of them did. But we have to watch our own children and see when they are ready. We have to see when they are able to become responsible for things like registering themselves for kindergarten. The growing child is nothing fixed. His feelings of belonging must be established and reestablished as he grows from the status of babyhood in the confines of home and family to the status of adolescent. Along the whole path of his growth, he is an active system of feelings, sensitivities, and conflicts. He has a family. He belongs to a family. He has friends and he has enemies. He's a boy or girl, short or tall, fat or thin, fast or slow, pretty or plain-faced, klutzy or graceful, and he has wishes and impulses that cannot be fulfilled. He's frightened of himself. He's ashamed. He's lonely or gregarious. He wins. He loses. He laughs and he cries. Yet, for all his small size and tenuous understandings, the young child is remarkably resilient under fire. With caring adults around him, his resiliency is augmented. When basic love is communicated to the child, he seems to go unscathed by the mistakes of us who love him. Part of this resiliency lies in his powerful, quite unacademic push to grow. This force that directs growth is not easily deviated or disrupted. Again and again, the young child is found handling minor or even moderately severe or conflicting stress unusually well, unless the abuse is massive, intense, prolonged, and generalized. His incredible toughness seems to be nature's way of ensuring the survival of the species. one day the telephone rang in my lab school, and a mother said they were moving. So right away I thought, oh, new space, I'll call the next mother on the list, on the waiting list. So before I had a chance to pick up the telephone or to look up her number, the telephone rang, and it was a woman from the Catholic Social Agency, and she said, do you take emotionally disturbed children? And I said, well, we aren't a school for the emotionally disturbed, but we might be able to handle the child, and I think it'd be better if he were put in with these normal children, if he doesn't disrupt the whole school. And I said, we'll try him. And all the time I was thinking of the next mother on the list, but I just knew that she would say, go ahead and take this boy, he needs it. As it happened, this child had been abandoned by his parents. All four children had been abandoned. He was the youngest, 4 years old. So they'd been distributed to different families, and he was in a foster home under the care of a psychiatrist. And I was so glad that I said, yes, we'll give him a chance. But all the while, I wondered, you know, well, what do I have ahead here? Can I cope? And when the social worker came with him, I looked at this child, and he was one of the most beautiful children I'd ever seen. And I said, oh, what beautiful brown eyes. And I didn't know how that was going to really give him strength to cope with this new situation of a nursery school. But when they usually took their naps on second floor. We had a tape recorder up there and played stories for them, and or music, so they could relax and rest for 10 or 15 minutes. And I asked the student teacher who was going to help up there if she would sit with this boy and just put his head on her lap and stroke him, just see if she could keep him calm as long as she could. And I said, when you find out that he just can't be still any longer, let him come downstairs with me, and that'll be fine. It wasn't long until I heard the little patter of footsteps down the stairs, and I opened the door, and there was Mike, and he said, but Mrs. Edmund, I do have beautiful eyes, haven't I? And, you know, I had told the children before he came that Mike was going to be a new boy, and that he needed their help. I said, I'm going to let him to do things that I don't let you do, but he needs this kind of help right now, so I want you to understand. And that I'm not doing this because I like him better or something, but he would sit, I'd always keep him close to me and maybe hold his hand or something when I presented a story or a learning experience. And when he got just too nervous, then one of the student teachers or maybe a student nurse, sometimes we had student nurses there too, would take him into the kitchen with a bowl of, to the sink with some warm sudsy water and some bottles to squirt or some boats to float, just anything to calm him down. And if you didn't know it before, warm sudsy water is real calming. I don't know if you've noticed it when you wash the dishes or not, but there's something very therapeutic about warm sudsy water. And I think a lot of us are missing that with our automatic dishwashers. But Mike was, he just came along beautifully, because all the other children were, they were really, you know, pulling for him. And it wasn't long until he just blended right in, and we didn't have to give him special privileges anymore. But I do think that if we can work these hyperactive children into a regular nursery school situation, that's much better for them. And as a rule, it doesn't hurt the other children too much either if they understand. Each child needs to know that he's a very special person. He needs to like himself in order to be able to like others. Whenever we say anything to a child that makes him think less of himself, we are destroying something very precious within him. Parents who label their child a stinker when he's born are drawing a pattern of expectancy for his life, and he'll probably live up to it or down to it. A mother who says in front of the child, "I can't do a thing with him, he never minds," or discusses his negative qualities in front of him is simply reinforcing that pattern of behavior. A misbehaving child is often a discouraged child. He has given up trying to please. It's much easier to get attention by misbehaving. We had a psychologist in the public schools in Oklahoma City who, when a child was turned over to him for consultation, he usually asked them to draw a picture of the parent he thought might be the problem. And this one child drew a picture of his mother and faced her to the wall. And the psychologist said, "Well, why did you face her to the wall?" He said, "If I'd turned her around, it would have been yakety, yakety, yak." So there was a problem. Good manners are reciprocal. And unless children are severely disturbed emotionally, most give as good as they get. One mother told a story about her son, age 4, who seemed especially grumpy at breakfast one day. And when she asked what was wrong, he replied in sort of a world-weary tone of voice, "Nobody ever says good morning, Alan. How do you feel, Alan, today?" All they ever said is, "Have you been to the toilet yet?" Learning begins at birth. But for the infant, it is centered largely in his biological search for balance in a natural, relatively simple environment. Beyond babyhood, life is not so protected. The 2, 3, and 4-year-old can be consumed by the energy it takes to cope with countless conflicts in his environment. While he tries to master speech, work out social relationships, and establish sensory motor skills all at the same time. Then, if ever, he needs a sensitive adult to help him pace his energies. When the child feels at ease with and fundamentally valued for himself, he moves spontaneously toward difficulty to new situations. It is as if he were responding to the adult's belief in his capacity and conviction that he will perform differently when it is possible to do so. Sometimes that support is evidenced by offering aid, by standing by, or simply accepting the child as he is. Exultant in his newfound powers, the child sometimes pushes too far. A block building topples, a puppet can't think of anything to say, friends leave him when his leadership turns to bossiness, and at such times, the adult role is crucial. If the child receives face-saving help, he can likely move toward the thoughtful reasoning out of the next steps, how to help a child cope. One grandmother I know had her 4-year-old grandchild with her for a while, and they were just bigger kids in the neighborhood, and they were out in the backyard playing, and of course before long he came in crying, and she stopped and talked to him, and the big kids had been a little naughty to him, I guess, and she says, "What do you think we ought to do about it?" He says, "You know, I think we should just have a cookie." Now that's one way of coping. Just forget it all, have a cookie. On the other hand, if he had been scolded or punished, it would have taken its toll of self-esteem, and his vulnerability would have taken over. If she'd say, "Well, now you must have done something," or, you know, "If you'd gone out there and played like you should have played, why, they probably wouldn't have done this to you." But instead, she helped him to to realize that he could find a solution. Quite often, if we do this, panic ensues. If we get tough with our child at a time when he's distressful, then that's a good time for him to regress. And he may even withdraw from adult help entirely. We must have flexible standards with our children and encourage them in terms of their own efforts. And of course, that's the secret of motivation. Don't compare one child with another. Don't pass the blame for his inability to cope to his parents or his playmates or his teachers. Now, this, I think, is very crucial. For when children get into trouble, you don't have to accuse them, but at the same time, try to avoid putting the blame on the next door neighbor or on the teacher or somebody that is remote as far as you're concerned. It's so easy to destroy the child's confidence in people, faith in people. And of course, that's faith is basic to mental and emotional health. But rather help him to see what he could do differently and how he thinks this situation could be coped with from his standpoint. How is he ready to handle it himself? Because if you start blaming someone else, then he'll pick up that pattern. And it's always somebody else to blame. He'll never feel free to take the blame on himself. Here is the basic freedom to make mistakes. That comes to real importance here. That if the child feels free to make mistakes, then he'll feel free to come in and say, well, he socked me, but I guess I had it coming because I was teasing him, or I did this, or I did that. We help him face up to his problems himself. I guess this is Gestalt or something. Theory that this is the real world, you know. Don't pass the blame on, but say, what can I do about it? Help him to appraise his problem and then act in a positive way to overcome it. This will help him toward self-understanding as well as a feeling of responsibility for his actions. And he'll enjoy some autonomy just in this thought, realizing that he has the power over the situation himself. Self-worth and well-being are maintained by putting his assets to use. We must emphasize his fortes, build up his self-confidence in the area where he can shine. It will give him courage to try new things, learn new skills, and on his own, attack really challenging things. In a series of experiments by Eisen and Berkowitz and Connor, it was shown that when people succeed, enjoying a warm glow of success, they experience positive effect, which in turn expresses itself in increased willingness to be kind to others. If he becomes a good student, it will be easy to encourage him to help those less fortunate than he, thus playing down the competition and instead emphasizing cooperation. Although we talk about building up a child's self-esteem, we shouldn't take this to mean that he should have self-esteem because he feels better than other people, but rather that he feels satisfied with himself. And then when he gets that feeling, he's willing to work outside of himself and become an outgoing person. And until he can feel that satisfaction, he doesn't have anything to work with. He doesn't have any strength to go and become an extending person. So I think parents and teachers, if they keep in mind, help the child develop the attitude that I'll do the best I can, and hope the child next to me will do the best he can. And who cares who is better as long as we're doing our best? Children, by their very nature, want to please the people who surround them with love and support. Love is the greatest motivating power. A child who is genuinely loved will think well of himself. When he thinks well of himself, he can't help but be a winner. Now, I'm sure that as I made my presentation, thoughts came to your mind and that you might like to bring up and talk about. I just welcome any suggestions or any ideas about motivating. I realize I emphasized early childhood, that's my field. But I think many of the principles of motivation work at any age level. Do any of you have any thoughts? I'd like to introduce John, who is here this week with the presentations concerning the retarded. And would you like to tell us a little bit about what you're going to do this week for us?
Well, I don't want to take any of your time, Doris. I found your discussion extremely helpful, useful.
Thank you.
And those are the kinds of things that need to be said more often, especially spiced with good examples like you. That was splendid.
Thank you. Yes.
I certainly agree on one of your first statements where you said, well, your child has got to want to learn in order to learn. And this is certainly true of a college student. Too many times we see freshmen in college particularly there because their parents want them to.
Yes. You know, that is one of the purposes that lifestyle here fulfills. They have a year for students here at Holden between, most of them come between their high school and their college. And during lifestyle, they get a great deal of freedom to learn, to make mistakes. They get exposed to some of the finest minds here in the village. We always have an excellent staff. And of course, we have a great library of tapes that they can listen to. They have three fine libraries here. And I think one of the values of lifestyle is that they come together and are exposed to people who are extremely enthusiastic, for instance, about poetry, writing poetry. They have the time span to write if they want to. They aren't locked in to this space has to be spend in math and this space has to be spent in language, but rather if they want to spend all week, you know, just doing poetry, they're free to do this. So that they establish an attitude toward learning that's one of you know, excitement. You know, here they can they're free to learn what they want to learn and zero in on specific things. They even learn Greek and German, but it's all conversational, and everything is approached with, you know, come and taste. If you like it, stay with it. And when they get to college, then they're ready. They're ready to zero in. And I know my husband said he's come in contact with several students at CLC who have spent that year here, and he said they're just, you know, really terrific. They know what they want, they have the right attitude toward learning, and they approach it as a really an exciting experience. And many of them came here because they weren't motivated, and they needed that year to really get a focus. And so it's just a shame we can't take more than 12. You know, it's just it's a real pity that we are restricted, but because the village does have power problems and they just can't take care of as many people in the winter as they can, you know, in the summertime, because they have to heat the different buildings. They can only heat so many, because when the glaciers stop melting, the water isn't rushing as fast, and they just can't generate the electricity that they can in the summertime. But here is an example of a child has to get ready. He has to mature enough so he can handle the college situation, because they're given all of a sudden a tremendous amount of independence and free time to use where they feel it should best be used, and they have to make judgments and decisions. And sometimes they're not ready to handle it when they're 18. They need another year. Any other thoughts?
I was wondering, sometimes I have a mother who will say to me, well, this is one child I can't cope with. She has such a mind of her own. And I sometimes see that this child and the mother's personality is very much the same. Mm-hmm. And is this...
Well, don't you notice that people usually marry someone who is just sort of the opposite from what they are? It seems like they kind of fulfill what they don't have, but if they were two people alike, there would naturally be conflict. Yes, I think this is very, very true, because there's nothing that disturbs a parent more than to see their child come along with the same shortcomings they've been struggling with all their lives. You know, a short temper, sort of a tendency to make sharp remarks when they really didn't mean to, be cutting, you know, or sloppy. People who have a real problem being neat themselves, there's nothing that really gripes them more than to see their child's room in a mess, and because right away all this guilt, well, that's the way I was, and that's, she's taking after me now, you know. It really hurts, and I think it's the guilt. You feel that you have passed on these bad traits to that child. Because that's what you're apt to see. You're not apt to see the child's good traits that they may be getting from you. It's the bad traits that loom up, and they hurt. Yeah. I think it's very true that it's more difficult to get along with your child if they're just like you, or quite a bit like you. Do any of the rest of you have thoughts on this?
I completely agree. It's the power of imitation, power of modeling, influencing other people by doing so. It also brings to mind the limits of so-called traditional counseling, where I feel there are definite limits, where without Christ you can't go beyond that. You can't say to that mother, well, sure, she's patterning herself after you, even though she doesn't want to, she's going to anyway. And you're going to probably pass that on even if you resist it. All you can do is bury it in Christ, you and your daughter both.
This is a good point, because you can bring it into your prayer time. And if you pray with your child, you can pray about these shortcomings in yourself. And the child will see they'll feel much easier about it and be more willing to ask for help in this area too.
I can see, Mom, that you can have more conflict with them. You also have a certain empathy or rapport.
Well, that's true.
Affinity with,
yes,
them. And while you might fuss with them more, they also are a close spot there.
That's right. That's very, very true. And you'll find that's the child, when that child becomes an adult, that's the child you'll be terribly close to. You will really identify.
You don't have to be responsible.
No, and you're not living in the same house.
Yes.
But you always have things to talk about, because there'll be the same interests there as adults, as a rule. I'm just talking about my observations. I don't know about any psychological studies in this area. I can't quote any authorities, but it's just been my observation that this is the way life is.
Well, I teach kindergarten, and so many mothers that feel so disturbed that they have a child that has a mind of their own.
Yes, you know? And they're the ones usually with a creative spark.
Right.
Yeah, that has had tremendous potential.
Well,
yeah.
This is great.
Like one mother said here, she was quoting Mark Twain in Tom Sawyer. His mother said, "Well, he'll probably be president if he isn't hung first."
Yeah.
and this is so true. I think this is one reason I particularly enjoy. I at one time taught a Sunday school class of just 10-year-old boys, and if you wanted to see a sparkly bunch of kids, just take them at 10 years old. And tremendous vivacity, you might say, and you harness it, and there's just nothing that they can't do or try or accomplish, you know, if you just approach them as though they're a privilege to work with rather than a problem. I think this is this is our problem a lot of times with a very positive child who wants his own way. You know, if we would stop to find out why they feel the way they do about this particular thing that they're arguing with you about, if you stop to listen a little bit, you might find some real logic in what they're trying to say. But they're a challenge. That's what it amounts to, a real challenge. And we can look at it as a privilege or a problem, one or the other. It's a little bit of each, I guess.
Something I need to be reminded of so much. The first thing my daughter's, she's only a year, first thing my daughter's doctor said to me, first morning he'd seen her, half a day old, he says, "Boy, do you have a sassy girl." And I really, kind of
I hope
worried
he didn't,
about it.
I hope he didn't say that so she heard it.
No. But he was right. She's funky from the minute she was born. And
sure.
I have to be reminded that it's a blessing that
yes.
she does have
yes.
a real exploring and real strong will about it.
Yeah, what you need to build up here is a consideration for others. You know, she can be tremendous. This can be a tremendous asset to her if she learns how to go about accomplishing what she wants to accomplish without stepping on others. This is a real trick and a real challenge. But they're all born differently. If they weren't, wouldn't it be dull? You know, it behooves us to watch them carefully, and just that's the only way we can learn to understand them. To watch them, to see what their fortes are, and to encourage them in the things that they lean toward, and not try to mold them into something that we think that we weren't able to do when we were a child, and we wish they would be different. And I think sometimes this is very hurtful to the child, and it can certainly be a cause of great sorrow to the parent who tries so hard, for instance, the father who tries so hard to make a football player out of the boy who'd rather play the violin. And it's something that we have to be aware of, that we appreciate them for what they have and for their individuality, not for their conformity.
I think it's especially important as we have more opportunities to choose the kind of schooling our children are going to have, to look to see the way your child is motivated. And particularly thinking now in terms of the fundamental schools versus the open classroom versus the traditional classroom, because some children work for the teacher, and the child that works for the teacher or for the praise and for the approval is going to be lost in the open classroom. On the other hand, the child that works because he's interested, because he's motivated, can be very unhappy in the traditional classroom. Because there's no motivation.
No.
Because he has to go along with it.
He isn't allowed his autonomy.
I think maybe we've gone overboard on that, and forgetting about these children that have to work at this particular stage of
yes.
the development for the praise, for the achievement, that they don't have that sense of autonomy. And
that's
these are
true.
The children that slip from one thing to another. And I think these are the children that need this extra year, because maybe in some ways they've been given, they've had enough of a concentration of approval, of feeling a sense of accomplishment in a particular area before they can go on to try.
That's right. That's right. Well, this is it. We need to know something about development, human development, and how a person develops and how we develop as individuals. The minute we start trying to put our children in a mold, we're in for trouble. And see, that has been a big problem with many of our public schools. We've been so overcrowded that in order to have some semblance of order in the classroom, we've had to become rigid. And then a teacher gets 30, 35 kindergartners in a room, and the mother calls the former nursery school teacher and say, this kindergarten is really terrible because they don't get to do this and that. I'd rather send them back to the nursery school for another year. And I'm inclined to say to that mother, why don't you just go over and visit someday and see what this teacher is coping with. More and more now we're getting the teacher's aides and we're getting parent helpers to alleviate the situation. But our public schools almost are confined to rigid schedules and curriculums if we don't have the adults to do an open classroom program. Any other thoughts here?
I was saying this just now at the coffee break, an example of enhancing or de-enhancing self-esteem. I have two little girls, and one of them came up, and she's a little chubby. And when she went out this morning, she had her shirt down over, and she looked fairly slender. And she'd been to the bathroom, and she stuffed this one of these new long t-shirts and stuffed it in, and it was all, you know, wrapped
around her stomach.
And without thinking, I said, oh, Renee, I said, pull down your shirt, your stomach's sticking out. And I thought, gee, I could have said, gee, Renee, you know, you really look so slender when your shirt's out.
Yes.
And, you know, it's just a quick thing, but, you know, gee, what did I do? I said, anyway, your stomach's sticking out. Put your shirt down.
Yeah.
And how often we do this without thinking.
Right.
That I could have made her feel, well, I'm really thin today.
You know,
yeah. My shirt's down, and I really
want to. Well, we all do this, and we're so quick to say the first thing that comes to our mind while we just think, you know, how would we like to have somebody come up to us and say that? You know, hey, you've heard people say, oh, you look so nice today. Well, what are they implying? There's more than one way to give a compliment, you know. And I had a little, one of my daughters said this to me one time. This, the mother of one of her friends had said that to her. She said, you know, don't I usually look nice? I'm sure the mother didn't mean it this way, but that's the way it came across. And we're doing it as teachers all the time. When we say something positive, we can say it. I mean, we can give a compliment and make it a put down. Very easy to do that. And we just have to stop and think, how does it sound? You know, like, Joe, you've been a real good boy today. What are we telling him? You know? Yeah. And we think we've said something positive. We think we've given him a stroke. We've just given it to him in the opposite direction because he can see a lot of things implied in this. Or, why, you made 100 today. That's great. That means that's quite unusual, you know, to make 100. I read an article once on 65 different ways of saying good for you. In this article, it's written by a man from Honolulu up in the University of Hawaii. I've forgotten his name, but there was so much truth in that article that there are just so many ways of giving positive reinforcement that we don't have to say it in the same way all the time. Put a little originality into it. Or just walking down and seeing something that the child has done, just say, wow, or that's great. Wish your mother could see that. Or, you know, there's so many ways that we can say good for you without it sounding trite and repetitive. Okay, thank you so much. I hope you can all go home and motivate yourself and everybody in your family.